Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin from Chicago, Mishkin Law, and I'm joined, as always, today by my co-host, Rob Hunt, who, after being traveling the last 2 weeks, has finally found himself in a location where he can join in and join us. Rob, how are you doing today?
I'm great. It's great to be back, Larry. Hopefully you haven't been able to miss me too much for the last couple of weeks, but I'm excited to be back on the show this week.
Well, we are excited to have you, and what a great day to come back. For those of you who are joining us today and listening, stop and call your friends and tell them to join too, because we have on our show today a guy who really kind of hits a home run for us. He's huge in the music scene. He's huge in the cannabis scene. And his name is Terry Haggerty. He is an original member of the band The Sons of Champlin from back in the day. And we're going to get to him in 1 second, but let's set the mood. And Dan, if you could spin for us our first song clip of the day, that would be great. Yes, that is the song Freedom. That is a Sons of Champlin song from their album Loosen Up Naturally. And as I was, I've known the song for a long time, but I was reading on it and everybody said, oh, for God's sakes, be sure to listen to the guitar solo. So we decided that was a good place to start. And we actually have the guy who played the guitar solo with us today, Terry Haggerty. Terry, thank you so much for joining the Deadhead Cannabis Show. It's great to have you here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Really, thank you for having me.
Well, anytime we can connect with somebody who helped, you know, create the sounds that we all grew up to, it's a real win for us. And as our listeners are going to find out in a few minutes here, you're more than just about the great music you guys laid out for us way back in the day, and continue to do so, as we'll also talk about. But you're helping out the other side of our show, too, with all the contributions that you're making in the world of cannabis. And I think that that's part almost even more exciting than the music. Some people might argue with that, but we'll get to that music soon enough. But let's talk for a few minutes about what you're doing with Haggalicious. What's it all about? How you got it started, and where's it going?
Well, you know, I can play right into what you just said, because when I was first turned on to cannabis, what was about 1965. And our manager at the time was Frank Werber, who managed Kings Trio, the We Five, and he had a whole bunch of other bands that never became famous like us. But he had the most amazing herb in the world. And so that was so early in my pot smoking life. And having smoked such excellent, almost unobtainable herb so early on, it really kind of set my sights on, and the realization that there was hardly any really good herb, like really excellent herb. Once you smoked it, you realize how rare it was. I've always said a tenth of 1% of all marijuana was that level of marijuana. And it always got absorbed in, you know, rich people always got it. So, you know, those of us that were broke hardly ever had an opportunity to smoke marijuana like that. But it had set up a real distinction for me about what I was looking for. And I've always had a background in botany and plants. And so when I saw marijuana seeds, they were as interesting to me as the pot itself. And so right from the beginning, from about 1969, I started saving seeds and keeping them in deep freeze. So a lot of genetics Hagelicious is about all is generated by, you know, by that distinction and those land race, you know, kind of heirloom varieties.
Well, and those are, like you say, I mean, you know, some of the most well-known and well smoked in terms of quantities that any out there. At what point for you did it cross the line from, you know, I'm growing here for myself and to make sure that I always have what I want into, wow, I can really kind of turn this into a business?
Don't think it ever was exclusively I'm growing it for myself.
Okay. So there was always, but back in 1965, it wasn't as easy as it is today.
No, it was. It was very, very hard. And I would say until the late 60s or early 70s, everything was very, very small. But, you know, it really generated a lot of, not income because there wasn't that much, but it was worth, you know, quite a bit. So in a lot of ways, because my music career was really on full tilt at that point, it ended up being a really great medium of barter for, you know, all kinds of stuff. And I've always made sure that everybody on every gig, sound guys, the roadies, everybody, make sure they get a nice bag. And I've done that forever. Well, lots of times I think people would hire me just to get some good pot, whether they like the music or not.
Well, you understand why we asked you to be on the show today, right, Terry?
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, that was my bad humor, but, you know, we're always happy to it. But that's really exciting. And, did you find that others in the music profession were, you know, as interested in following along with this as you were, other than just enjoying it for the, you know, mental benefits they would get from it?
Not the people that I knew. And I think I knew pretty much everybody in all the landmark San Francisco bands. No, it was, you know, there were so many just like, you know, amazing outlaw smugglers back then, you know, just, I mean, Goldfinger always comes to mind because he's such part of the lexicon of everything. But there was a handful of them. And then there was all the people that I knew that turned me on to the Goldfingers and Bob Blacks and, you know, the whole Oli and just the whole international world of smugglers. So I always had access to some pretty amazing herb because those were the level of people that I interacted with. And as I get further and further into having a seed catalog, I always had a standing thing with everybody that I'll pay you more than anybody else for your really best herb. You know, I was going to LA and doing sessions and playing on a bunch of stuff. So I knew so many people that would, you know, just about pay anything, you know, most of them just really big record company owners and, you know, pretty amazing high up their people. And they would pay anything for the good for, you know, a number of reasons. Number one, because it's great to be the guy with the kind. And number two, because, you know, it was so hard to get that you just had to kind of aggressively pursue it. So back since, you know, and then I got really involved with wine and I helped a whole bunch of growers start and supplied them with a bunch of genetics. And there's a common root of really great genetics that comes from the 60s into the, you know, 70s and the 80s. And for me, it started with a Brotherhood of Eternal Light because they liked us and we played gigs with Spirit, and, you know, took acid with them and hung out. And they'd bring in these amazing loads of hash and we're making their sunshine acid. But they brought back a pound of Mazar-e Sharif seeds, and they were the most exquisite, incredible seeds. So I managed to get a handful of those seeds that I crossed with a 1969 Colombian Chiba weed. Another variety is a 1972 really high altitude Michoacán that's almost white when you look at it. It's got so much crystal on it. And then a 1974 Michoacán that everybody called Ice Bag at the time that I got from Goldfinger. And between those three varieties, they're kind of like the core progenitors of almost everything I do now. And seeing I've been doing it for 50 years, like all these things have really, you know, developed through breeding into, you know, a number of different things, you know, probably 36 varieties that I can really, you know, distinguish as being really not variants of something else, but really unique things. And, you know, I've got like a lot of the most amazing seeds you've only heard of. And, because I've kept them in deep freeze for so long, I don't know if they'll start, but I know with maybe a little gibberellic acid, just like a little sterile coaxing, that they will crack open. Because I started some 1974 Mazari seeds that were crossed with these Michoacans last year, and out of 30 seeds, I got 3 to sprout, and out of those, I got a male and a female, so then I crossed those up, but I also am growing that variety of females. So, you know, seeds run out of gas, but it lasts a long time if you initially kept them in a pretty deep freeze.
Yeah, Terry, does that mean that when you were first getting these original strains, was that when the Brotherhood was still down on Laguna Beach? Were you part of the whole Laguna Canyon scene as well?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, completely. And, you know, Tim Leary was out there in the one house out in Laguna Niguel. There was nothing out there, just that one house. And, you know, everybody go out there. And the standard thing for the Brotherhood, the way I remember it, is you take like a giant handful of sunshine. You're like 30 of them. And, you know, then everybody would hang out and play music. And when somebody would just go out and leave their body, then everybody would run over and just do this energy thing with them. I mean, people were really way, way into it. And they had so much money. And and the mayor of Laguna Beach was one of them. I mean, it was really quite the knucklehead scene, you know, in a nice way.
Yeah. I mean, from everything I've read, that was, you know, essentially Bear was running the Bay Area and the Brotherhood was running Southern California. As far as, like, when I say running, just the dissemination of massive, massive amounts of LSD at the time. And just turning on as many people as they could in both parts of the coast.
Yeah, no, Bear is great. He's been a friend for a long, long time. And way back then, I remember him coming to the Avalon Ballroom when we were playing there. And he did this for all the bands. He'd make these little leather pouches. And then he'd put a bunch of hits of LSD in there. And in this particular time, there was like about 50 White Lightnings in one bag and 50 Purple Hazes in another. And he was just making sure everybody got them.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, Bear's was always a great artist, and as much as he was a sound engineer and a chemist, you know, his metal work and his leather work, so many cool things that he used to put out.
Yeah, no, he really interesting. As I think a Starfinder said, you know, my dad isn't the kind of guy that can modulate his behavior. He just does what he does. But, you know, I really loved him. I tried to help him grow it in Australia. And I gave him a whole bunch of seeds, and I told him which ones I thought would do good. But, you know, he decided that those weren't the seeds he wanted to grow, and he grew some other ones, and they were okay. But, he didn't grow the ones. But that was kind of going through the process with him. And When the Dead fired him eventually to be a sound guy, and then they were getting back together again, that first configuration, our friend Wizard, who worked for the Suns for a long time and was working on the Harry Potter movies in England, and the Dead hired him to do the sound for their tour. And so Bear calls me up, and he says, "They don't want me back, but I should be back." And I said, "Well, I agree with you, Bear. I think you've got some wild ideas." And so I hooked him up with Wizard. And Wizard was totally excited to have Bear on the crew. And my God, did I receive grief for that. You know, it's just like that. That was never going
to
happen.
Always good to be on Bear's good side, huh?
Yeah. You're always on my good side. I just won't pick up after a point, you know.
Wow. Well, we've got another music clip for you here, Terry, and so we're just going to keep throwing them out here for a few minutes. Normally, this would all be Dead clips, but as long as we have you on the show today, by God, we're gonna feature a little Suns music. And Dan, why don't you go ahead and spin that second clip for us?
Mm-hmm.
the specific reason why we picked this Big Boss Man clip is because you're right, it's from Winterland, and you know, on YouTube it just says 71 or 72, but in the notes they talk about Garcia playing. And what I was really looking for was the Yogi Phlegm show from March of 75, when you guys were late to the show. And so Jerry and Phil came out and played with the other guys until you got there, because Graham was forcing them to go on, or he was going to cancel the contract or something.
Yeah, no, Bill could be that way. And, you know, we had a few gigs that we played for Bill where he came up to us at the end of the set. He said, "I'm paying you twice as much." We're going, "Oh, God, you're kidding." He says, "You played so good, you deserve twice as much." So he was really pretty fabulous that way. He had this solar plex energy that could make you shake just looking at you. But if he wasn't doing that to you, then he was pretty great. And both of his long-term secretaries, Annie Hatch and then Rita Gentry, were both the Sun's secretaries before they went over to Bill's. And one of Annie's jobs, because she was between Green, what's her first name?
Honey.
Between Honey Green. So she was her, and then Honey, and then Rita. And she would always tell us, she says, "Well, one of the big gigs is like Bill keeps every penny, and he's got this big, giant bathtub, and it's just at the end of the week, it's filled with coins. And that's part of my gig, is I've got to roll all these coins up and take them to the band and deposit them." Because, you know, it was early filled.
I mean, Bill Graham's stories are great. Give us a little bit of background on the Sons of Champlin, how they came to be and what they were all about.
Let's see. The Sons were preceded by a band called The Opposite Six. And The Opposite Six had a record company on Dot, really an excellent band, Dance Steps, Full Uniforms, really great arrangements. And when that guitar player, Don Irving, left the band to go and play with the Bo Brummels, they hired me to play in the band. And then that band turned into the very early Sons, the five-piece Sons that we did Loosen Up with. And, you know, it was all Marin County. We'd all been playing together since before we could drive cars. Our moms would drive us around to each other's house so we could play. And, we signed with Capitol, did a couple albums with Capitol. I forget what the order is, but, you know, a number of different record companies. And, that was our real psychedelic era. That was the era where I was, you know, taking acid, geez, like 15 out of 30 days, forever. We'd all take acid on the jets flying back and forth. And, you know, we just figured we were going to go for it and see what that was like, you know. And so all the music that came out of that era was just so completely LSD driven. And then our manager at the time, Fred Roth, was friends with Gary Snyder, and he did these shows called Mandala Mandalographies, where Gary would read his poetry and Fred would show slides. He'd have a whole bunch of those different slideshow things, and they'd morph and stuff like that. So Gary Snyder was a big influence on us. He wasn't really into hanging with a band that much, but because he was in such close proximity, the whole philosophy and us being so young and Turtle Island, it's just, you know, really just kind of rubbed off. And then the person we got to actually spend time with was Alan Watts, because we all had this guru guy, Albert Saijo, that everybody looked up to. And we'd go there as a band and have dinner, and Alan would be there, and we'd listen to him talk philosophy for, you know, hours on end. And after doing that, we'd come back and we'd write these Sons tunes, you know, because it was just so compelling, and it's much better than living at home with your parents, you know.
Absolutely. So this is what I wanted to ask you about that, though, Terry. You're talking about a time, I guess, what, like in the mid-1960s?
The mid-60s with Frank Werber, and then late 60s with the first Capitol albums. And we broke up the first time in 1977. So we'd morphed from a full-on hippie band to a band trying to write a hit record into, you know, one of this, we all had nudie suits and that whole phase. And, you know, we went back and forth from no horns to lots of horns. And I think one of the highlights of the later 70s phase was having Mark Isham in the band, because, you know, that was really musically just, you know, quite quite an influence on things. And
I'd love to hear a little bit about Bill, because it seems to me that, you know, what you're describing was him moving towards a sound that was ultimately played by Chicago, which is the band he joined, correct?
He joined Chicago. I don't know that's what it is, because when we were playing, I think it was Fillmore West, before there was Winterland, and when Bill had moved from Fillmore to Fillmore West there on Market Street, Jim Guercio came to hear us, and there was no such thing as Chicago. And he got us all together, and you know, Jim Guercio was Chicago's manager. And so what he said to us, he says, "Horn, you know, I've never heard a rock and roll band with horns like this." He says, "I want to manage you. I want to get you record deals. I want you to come with me." We were just so idealistic, and we really didn't understand anything about business per se. And we told him, "No, we like our manager." So literally within 6 months of that, Jim Guercio went and he put together Chicago. I mean, that whole entire band, Terry Caff, all those people were a product of Jim Guercio putting them together. And he did it because he couldn't get the Sons. So later when Bill went to Chicago, it was kind of a natural fit, because, you know, a lot of the textures and a lot of the roots that influenced all of us were so common, you know. And Bill's great. I mean, Bill really is amazing. You know, we've had our differences, but we're really having quite a bit of fun now. And one thing I can say about Bill, because he's the person I took more LSD with than anybody. And once you get to see that part of somebody, you can never see them other than Bodhisattva, you know. And, you know, we're all kind of like little Siddharthas getting lost and waiting for the river to talk to us, kind of. So that's my overview of just about every bit of it, actually.
Okay.
So back in that time, Terry, you know, which rooms did you love playing? Was it, you know, the Fillmore, or was it the Avalon, or was it, you know, like, obviously the Warfield and the Great American Music Hall? There's just so many great rooms in San Francisco. Which ones were you playing? Which ones were you really stoked when that was where your gig was?
Oh, the Avalon. Everybody. Avalon, God bless his soul, Chet. You know, the Avalon, I mean, if you were psychedelic and you wanted to be psychedelic and you wanted to go to a place that was safe to be psychedelic, you went to the Avalon. And, I mean, that was amazing.
And that was when Chet Adams and the Family Dog were running the Avalon.
Oh, yeah, right from the beginning. And, you know, Chet was, you know, in my mind, really a saint. You know, I love Chet. You know, he gave two people these really beautifully signed pictures right before he died, David Freiberg and me, you know, because he says, "Well, you guys really were the guys that played for free more than anybody else." So that was the Sun's thing, you know.
That's a good group of two to be in, man. You and Freiberg, huh?
Oh, yeah. No, I love David. You know, I just saw him the other day. So, you know, he's doing great. He just had his, what was it, his 81st birthday? David Freiberg?
Yeah, I think so.
His 81st birthday, yeah.
Does it, besides the fact, I mean, you know, I blinked my eyes and I went from 20 to 60, but, you know, you guys are all a few years older than that. Does it surprise you to see how many of your, of the, you know, the guys who started out with you are still on their feet? I just saw Dead & Company a week ago at Wrigley Field. You know, they took about a 20-minute break, but otherwise they were on stage for almost 4 hours. I saw Phil Lesh last fall. He's 81 or 82, and he's playing for 3.5 hours. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things, the big differences between that, what ended up being a dividing thing between Bill and I, was I love that about those guys. That's what I wanted to do. again, when I was working with Steve Kimmock, I mean, my God, we'd play for 4 or 5 hours. Everybody'd be so stoned. You know, everybody'd be there. The family'd be there. The kids would be on the blanket. You know, it would just be going and going, and you'd play like hour-long tunes. And it was just the most beautiful essence of consciousness flowing and being one and nobody being special. And, you know, all the things that really mattered to me as far as being psychedelic. And the last thing in the world I wanted to do was like be in a band that wrote hit records and stuff like that. But when you think about the venues that these different approaches take on, you know, one is really big show and dance and 90 minutes of torque with a big encore. And the other one is a stream of consciousness thing, you know? So, and the stream of consciousness thing, when the Suns were there, God, we would just reach heights that we couldn't any other way than getting in that continuum and it building and opening up. And so I miss that. And at some point with the Suns, it just philosophically just didn't serve my kind of, I guess, Buddhist nature, you know? I mean, I scribed a little bit of everything, but I like thinking that way. So,
let me ask you this question, Terry, because what you were just saying, I want to build on a little bit. All these acts that came out of that particular part of the world at that particular time, right? You guys and the Dead and the Airplane and Quicksilver and Moby Grape and just on and on and on with all of them. And it seemed like the defining characteristic in all of them was their love of live performance, you know, almost to the exclusion of studio work, that they wanted to be out, they wanted to be playing live, they were always playing live, and the Dead kind of carried that on probably a little bit farther. But what was it about what was going on out there that just, you know, kind of imbued everybody with this love of music, but it was all about, let's just go out and play. We don't need to do the 3-minute hits that are going to, you know, make us some, you know, quick pocket change and stuff like that.
Before you answer that, building on that, you know, what was the feeling when the Airplane did have a hit record, or when, you know, Janis had a hit record, where all of a sudden, like, things were a little turned upside down, that bands that kind of were there for the love of playing, now all of a sudden were, you know, superstars. You know, it seems to be kind of a juxtaposition as far as what the idea and the mantra was versus what the reality was when all of a sudden the San Francisco scene just became that hot.
Well, you know, the thing that most people don't realize is the Jefferson Airplane was like in a category of their own. I think they were just so highly educated, so intelligent, and they really had, they could be pretty snarky, you know, and they were different. They were just different than the rest of us. And, but, you know, not committed to the cultural, you know, revolution, you know, expanding consciousness thing. They were just really, really smart. And they had a lot more sarcasm and a lot more stuff. Like, you know, Paul Kantner and Grace. Paul was a dear friend. I've known Paul forever. I mean, I just really looked at Paul and his mind and how trippy he could be. But there was always this underlying snarky thing. You know, if you hung with the Grateful Dead and you went to Page Street or something like that, nobody's being, that's just not the way that was, you know, or Quicksilver or any of the, you know, that was unique to the Airplane.
Was that true of all of them? Was that Marty and Yorma also, or was it just, you know, Grace and Jack?
Oh, I mean, you know what? I played out there at Yorma's place, and early on, Yorma was, you know, just my opinion, but Yorma was really, you didn't get a lot of energy from Yorma. I guess that's the nicest way I could say it.
He's the hottest guitar player in the East Bay at the time, huh?
It's, you know, it's all perspective, because if you came up through my world, which was like bebop guitar players and organ trios and just incredible technicians, pretty much most of the, it took me a while to realize and hear the community in everybody's playing and the connectedness. But it surely wasn't about, at least for me, it surely wasn't about any technical prowess on the instrument. But it really did say something about how vapid, you know, technique and intellectual application to your instrument can be without some heart and some connectedness. Yeah. So I think the biggest thing about the 60s for all of us, but I should go back about that because, you know, I played out there in Yorma's place. My God, he's the most elegant, loving human. You know, it's just like, it's amazing. And we were just laughing. I was just saying, my God, Yorma, I just, this is the most amazing thing. You know, you just really turned into this just beautiful, loving human. You know, that's just great. You know, a lot of crazy drugs, though, you know, and people don't want to talk too much about how detrimental drugs were. You know, it's like cocaine, the heroin, you know, all the keyboard players dying, you know. Because my parents were professional musicians, and I was educated and met a lot of amazing musicians that were really fucked up. So the 60s wasn't anything new to me. And when I saw a lot of things, I was so outspoken about them. Like, if you came to a gig, my gig, when you went into the bathroom and you got a bunch of people in there, you were snorting cocaine, I'm locking the door on you, or I'm going in there and I'm taking the cocaine away and I'm kicking you out of the gig. That's it. And as people got to know that about me more and more, you know, he's not a fun guy to hire. I mean, that's kind of a hassle.
Got to keep your standards.
But, well, it just seemed like that's not what we're doing, is it? Like,
that's pretty common these days. A lot of musicians now have, you know, backstages that, you know, are relatively sober backstages by comparison to what you used to see.
Oh, yeah.
The trend seems to be, you know, let's keep the backstage roar to a minimum and let's keep it relatively clean.
Oh, you know, when I played this Suns thing just a couple of days ago, it was like, I haven't done this in a long time. I can't smoke any pot. My pot's so strong. I just got to really pay attention to this because, you know, we didn't realize we were so young and we were in the self-discovery mode, and we didn't realize really the responsibility we had each other to kind of keep it together a little bit at least. But that's what happens when you get older, right?
And no doubt about it. Try to tell your kids that and see what they say. If they're like mine, they just laugh at you.
Yeah, well, mine just told me, they says, if you raised us like you think you did, you don't have the slightest idea what we're doing. And we're definitely not telling.
You said earlier, you know, you mentioned Kimmock, and, you know, Kimmock is definitely kind of a younger generation than the guys you were discussing as far as everyone that came up in the San Francisco scene together. But who is it that's playing today that you go, wow, those guys get it? You know, like they're really carrying the torch for kind of the scene that you guys started 50 years ago. But who are you looking at now? Well, you know, these are musicians I just think are exceptionally talented and are really fun to watch them progress.
You know, there's a number of young guitar players here in Marin that are the kids of musicians that are really, really great. And I think the thing that they miss right now is because there isn't that really there isn't as inquisitive a musical audience as there was in the 60s and the 70s. You know, you just don't see venues where, you know, Charles Lloyd and Grateful Dead and the Skittle Band all play together and everybody loves each one and listens to them. So, music, you know, younger musicians now are under the pressure to be so much technically better, but they try to be jacks of all trades and they, you know, they try to make a living. I don't think any of us ever thought about making a living. And my dad was a studio player and he worked all the top gigs in San Francisco when I was young. And so before I took acid and joined the Suns, I was playing the musicals and playing his jobs that he couldn't do, and was, he just had all the beautiful suits and the custom cars and everything was just tricked out. And, you know, and all it took was one hit of acid to just go like, well, that's a lot of work for something I don't want anymore.
That's true too. Tell us a little bit about your relationship and the son's relationship with the Grateful Dead, and maybe one or two stories you can give us about that.
Well, let me go all the way back to the kind of beginning. I guess it was 1968, maybe 69, and our manager comes in, Fred, and because he's so involved with the art community and a lot of people in the hate, and the tourists are really starting to show up more and more, and there's just like a real angst about how the hate is changing. So there was a meeting about it at the Hate Theater, and our manager, who knew Jerry better than I did at the time, says, let's go, let's listen to Jerry talk. And I said, you mean Jerry Garcia? And he says, yeah, no, he's going to talk at this thing. And that Jerry was so eloquent, so erudite, so unbelievably, he just pulled the essence of what we were doing as beatniks, turning into hippies, being psychedelic people with a vision of the world being better. And he was addressing so much of the Buddhist nature of change. Well, he was an amazing guy to listen to. That. And so that's my first real remembrance of Jerry personally. And then I was playing with him a bunch with Howard Wales and playing there at the Matrix and all those places. So I got to know him pretty good and became pretty good friends. We didn't see each other a lot, but we'd see each other at some really nice times. And I initially met Jerry. I was working for Bill Corey's Teens and Twenties, and I think I was in the band that was backing the Everly Brothers. And there was a Binky's Pizza across the street, and I went there to get a pizza, and there was this guy missing a finger playing banjo there. And I introduced myself, and he says, yeah, my name's Jerry Garcia, and I never thought about it until a couple of years later when I saw, you know, the Morlocks and the Grateful Dead, and said, I know that guy. Yeah, it, you know, Bay Area is a small thing, especially back then with musicians.
So, when Howard Wales was, you were playing with those guys, was that during the Hooterall years, or was that a separate ensemble?
It was, you know, Howard just had everybody playing with him. It was amazing. He had some really great producers produce some of his stuff. He, you know, he put out all of his gorgeous albums, the amazing art on them, and music being really good. And I always saw Jerry at those things. And then, you know, the Dead hired us to, we took on management. Sam Cutler started managing them. Then we signed a contract with Sam, and he was our kind of booking agent, like the out-of-town bookers, out-of-town tours. I think that's what they called themselves at the time. So we were managed by that whole group for, I think, 3 or 4 years. And that's when we did the Columbia album that Phil got us, because we were all so, you know, close together. And, yeah, and then Jerry kind of just became a little bit more distant. And, you know, it's an interesting story because back in, I guess, 67 or 68, a friend of mine sent me 8 pounds of opium from Nepal. And back in those days, it would just show up in the mail. So I got this big box with...
Can I clarify? Did you say 8 pounds of opium in the mail?
8 pounds of opium in the mail, yeah.
That's amazing.
And, you know, back then, you know, that was what people weren't really paying attention to that in the early days. You know, LSD was legal. Barry Melton told me, he said, oh, my first trip was like, you know, in 65 when acid was legal. I was going, oh, fuck, that's right, you know? So anyway, I've got this, I open this box up and I look at it and I say, oh, God, hashish, how great. So I get out my pipe and I'm trying to smoke it and the stuff won't burn and it won't burn.
That's not hash.
And all of a sudden I'm starting to get sick to my stomach and get all loosey and I go, oh, shit, this is opium. So I called Jerry and I said, I've got 8 pounds of opium. I'll trade you a pound of opium for a pound of pot. And that's what we did.
That's crazy. I mean, I grew up in a time where, you know, you could still walk through metal detectors in the airport with, you know, cold pounds in your carry-on. and not get popped, you know, sort of pre-Unabomber days. And certainly after 9/11, that changed completely. But mail orders that we were doing certainly weren't anything like that. And, you know, if it was a couple pounds of mushrooms in the mail, you were pretty happy when it arrived at the other end. And normally you just write return to sender on the box and stick it out in your back porch. So if anyone did, you know, show up, you, this wasn't for me. Not that I would probably hold any weight in court, but, you know, at the time we thought that was genius of saying, like, oh, we refuse delivery. But honestly, you just upped the ante with 8 pounds of opium through the mail.
No, it's just happened, you know. It's just my friend Mitch sent it to me, and there it was, you know. And but no, those days were different. You know, you could just put, like, you know, 1/4 pound of pot in an oatmeal container, and you could tape it up, and you could send it away. But we're talking before any of this camp stuff or anything happened. And you know, the thing that's so interesting about the whole drug war is my wife has theater friends, and she's an excellent singer and really teaches vocals to, you know, a lot of professional people that come through and do the shows like Wicked and all these things. So, you know, we get to meet a lot of folks like that. And God, I shouldn't have smoked it. I'm just lost my train of thought.
Well, let me do this, because, you know, sometimes I'm not much better at that than you. I just went and saw Dead & Company for 2 nights at Wrigley Field. They probably pulled in about 35,000 to 40,000 people for both nights. Now, I attribute that to the fact that there's a lot of deadheads out there like me who like to go to the gathering of the tribe and be part of the whole crowd. And there's Bob Weir up there doing his thing, and how wonderful that is to see. But what always strikes me is, while I'm never close to being the oldest guy in the show, I'm far from being the youngest. And what's amazing to me is every year, the crowd gets younger and younger, but it's not just that people are bringing their kids. I mean, these are kids like my kid's age or maybe even younger, but they've got the tie-dye t-shirts. They've got the headbands. They've got the bell bottoms. They've got, it's as if you picked them right up out of the 60s almost. What is it that's keeping this spirit alive, you know, that's keeping the Dead popular and relevant, that's keeping this whole, do you have an answer for that?
Oh, yeah, sure. I think, you know, nobody represents, you know, a new life breaking away from the conditions of your parents and, you know, all the social, religious things that you have shoved down your throat before you know any better. And that, in the essence, for me, was what the 60s was about. And every generation of kids feels that way at a certain point. And depending on how, you know, it's everything's about how you were raised. And, you know, there's so many conditions that send you off in life. But a lot of people really want to have a life that has enough in it materially, but not too much. And when you're young, you don't have the same perceptions about time as you do when you're old. So you commit to big ideas. And nothing was a bigger idea than what we did in the 60s, you know, what the Dead represented, what the Suns tried to represent, you know. And that's compelling, because when you look around, there's all kinds of amazing stuff, but there's nothing like that. And so I've always figured that it was some of the most intelligent young people, basically, when they look at what their options are, they really want to be part of a community. We're communal creatures. It's that's always was the great thing. I spent a lot of time at the Oregon Country Fair, and boy, there's just this a thing about community that is everything. And we played so many shows with the Dead, and even when I didn't think they were very good, when you went out in that audience, it was just such an amazing, nice experience and a connected experience. Everybody's so happy to see each other, you know, everybody coming from everywhere, you know, and it's just like this continuum of a good life, you know, and most of the people I ever met there out there in the audience, they were all techies, they're all incredibly competent people, really, you know, incredible high-end lives, but they just eventually found permission to draw a line in the Grateful Dead and in that culture, you know? And there is no place else to look for that relief other than if you really understand something, then you can think magically about it too, because it's based in facts and reality. But the magic is the future that you're creating by thinking about it. And that's kind of how we were raised in a lot of ways, is that, you know, the thoughts you think are the future you're making. And we just wanted to shift that whole paradigm to really just be thinking some nice thoughts about more than ourselves. And, you know, it's just made so much sense. And I think kids are, I think every generation is just that way, you know. So bless them, you know, if they go out. And I love talking to David about, like, Ted and Company, because he has such a nice relationship with them, you know. And so, I mean, that says quite a bit, because, you know, I think the world of David, and I just love what he's done with his life and how much better he's gotten musically. He's actually good and writes incredible tunes. And I really don't know what to say more than we're communal creatures, and it's good to be part of a community, and it's good not to be sold a bunch of crap. So.
Well, absolutely. And just to give a quick shout out to David Gans, who Terry just mentioned.
I was going to do the same thing. Yeah. You know, thank you, David, for teaming us up with Terry today. And we're huge fans of yours, David.
Absolutely. Cannot thank you enough. David was a guest on our show a while back, and couldn't have been more gracious in terms of the stories he shared with us. And in an effort to help us bring our show along, Terry, he made the connection to you, and we couldn't be happier about it. So we really do thank David again. And it's just so great to be able to, you know, have somebody such as yourself who has that connection back to this period of time that so many of us that, you know, didn't come of age until the, you know, the early 1980s or the late 1980s, depending on which one of us you're talking to. It's you know, that whole period of time is it's like this you know, mystery to us. You know, we hear it, we see it, we feel like we can sense it and touch it a little bit in the music that comes out of it. But, you know, to be able to actually hear people who were there and who were part of it and, you know, contributing into the scene and all of that is, I think it's just inspiring for any of us who have any interest at all in that area.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing that's great is you get to learn from the mistakes and you get to go forward. And it's interesting because, like, I've always used the phrase, you had to be there. But one of the things I've realized about the counterculture is it lives in the moment, and it always has the shape and the form of modern, the life in the moment. But with marijuana, you had to be there. If you weren't there, there's no chance that you're going to get there. And unless somebody actually, like, digs deep and gives you something, some genetic little package, that's it. And so that's what makes it so interesting, because for people like me that have this, you know, genetic trove of stuff and also a responsibility to, maybe humankind is too big a word, but have a responsibility to my peers and the people that like to get conscious to not monetize it to the point where it's unavailable. And that creates the amazing conundrum that most people, if they get their hands on it, they'll go, okay, you don't have it, I'm going to make a ton of money. So there is this thing of just riding this thing out and try to, I'm making the most amazing connections at this point in my life. Everybody I'm talking to is like a PhD in some amazing, you know, biology, molecular biology. And my stuff basically is unique enough where I think I hold a lot of keys to the genome, because, you know, they've sequenced like hemp, but they really don't have a clue what all the sequences of the magical stuff is. And so people like me, and I'm hoping there's many more people like me, just haven't seen a lot, but, you know, figure they're wise and patient and the time isn't yet for them to come out, you know? But those are the, you know, we're all the people that are going to hold the codes to be able to bring back the really ancient stuff, you know? And there's all kinds of stuff that's on their horizons, but it's, you know, $10 or $100 million away and 10 years away. So, but, you know, it's that it's working for those things and understanding the science well enough that probably distinguishes me from a lot of my peers. They're also great growers and stuff. But, you know, like, I mean, from almost the minute I got into this, I was thinking about, you know, agar and tissue culture and, at a molecular level. So it's an ever-changing, expanding thing that goes faster and faster.
So, you know, having known a lot of the geneticists that are in the California market, and, you know, the guys are holding on to some of the most amazing cuts and doing a lot of the breeding to breed new cuts, you know, I've been really, really concerned with the California market, especially in the legal side, based on, you know, the taxation that's been hitting. Are you happy to see what Gavin Newsom just did as far as, you know, relaxing the cultivation tax for the next 3 years? Is that going to make an impact on the success of your business?
I think it'll make an impression. I don't think it'll make that much impression unless they really, really get rid of all those onerous, you know, draconian taxes, because it's really a piece of shit, terrible thing. The one thing that I've always known about this, because, you know, whether it was smuggling stuff or bringing stuff from Hawaii, I never have tried to monetize my genetics, because for decades I've been aware of the fact that as soon as somebody gets it, it's lost. So I've always held that really close to my vest, and because I could deal with the very high end things at the highest prices and had a whole network for that, basically I didn't need to. But now people come to me and they go, well, why haven't we seen your stuff before? And I just say, think about it. I never tried to make money off of it. There's no way that you would have ever have seen it. And I have the patience of Job. That's what I tell everybody, you know.
So you've been guarding your genetics then for 50 years, and you've just been doing minor breeding internally, where the only people that actually get to sample what you've been producing are just close friends and family. And other than that, you know, you're only releasing some of these cuts now?
That's right. It hasn't been the right time since now.
That is the patience of Job for sure. I mean, I know a lot of guys have held on to some cuts for a long time, but ultimately someone always gets their hands on them. So I don't know how you've kept the garden that long without anyone ever saying, like, oh, come on, let me get one clone of that. That's pretty amazing.
Well, it's not like that. My very great varieties are the only varieties that I've ever had, you know, and a lot of those varieties, that's exactly the thing that happened. But I've always been very clear. I have what I consider to be progenitor varieties that are my genetics company is called Unobtainium LLC. And in that, I have those really ancient genetics that will never be sold and they'll never go out. So if you want to engage me in the business, there's two things I'll do for you. I think I could probably create, you know, 1,000 different new varieties with the genetics I have, and just trying to find the right partner to do that with. And the other thing is, yeah, I have so many secondary levels of genetics. Like, one of the things about marijuana is there's a great paper by Robert Clark, and it's called The Botany and Ecology of Cannabis. It's his doctoral thesis on cannabis. And in it, he explains where the psychoactive ingredients in marijuana are. So, you know, when I read that, it really changed my way of looking at marijuana. And if you take the whole trichome with the little round ball and then the stem, and then it's resting on a base of cells, that base of cells is where all the active stuff is. The terpenes and everything is and the rest of the stuff. But the molecules that really make marijuana amazing are in those base cells. And they come from 2, which is like the most rudimentary hemp, to 24, which is stuff that probably doesn't exist anymore. So I'm thinking that maybe my best marijuana has 20 or 22 cells down in those base cells. And so as soon as you understand that, and then you start looking at it, not just from the smoking place, but there's just so many morphological things that point things out to you, the quality of the resin, you know, like lots of things are greasy and they spread out all over your hands. And then there's other things that when the trichomes get in your hand, they feel like sand. And so the ones that feel like sand are definitely far superior to the other ones. And then in the scheme of varieties and stuff, like back in the early 70s, a bunch of Pakistani hash was brought in, and there was seeds. And the people in Humboldt started crossing a lot of their varieties with this Pakistani hash. And so now when you smoke a lot of those varieties in Humboldt, they all have a common taste that's way down in the bottom. And it's really not that beautiful, refined Mazari thing. It's you know, it's more like that grinding hash plant thing. And it's just basically because it made a lot of weight. Everybody wanted to grow it. And because marijuana was so legal, everybody could sell their marijuana. And eventually it just got to the point where like all the really good genetics were just kind of bred out of it. And there wasn't anybody really keeping the genetics. So now they have the conundrum that where, you know, it's hard to find anything that you really want to smoke. So that's probably the worst thing that's happened to California. And I'm a really firm believer that the plant itself is a conscious entity. And I've always told people, if the plant had its way, every mom and pop would be growing it. Everybody would be motivated growing the best. The evolution of that plant would just rocket forward because there'd be hundreds of thousands of people working on this big collective genetic thing, you know, and it would be in the side of a community. It would be inside of something safe that made sense, you know, and we'd really be rocking all that conservative crap to death, you know, like, you know, just smoke this and stop thinking that crap, you know, like, let's get high, you know.
Wow. That's fantastic. Terry, my follow-up for you is this. How do people like you, you know, what those of us would call the old guard in the cannabis world, how do we bring your knowledge and understanding and overall feeling and looking at the cannabis to this new modern adult use market where a lot of it seems to be all about profits and, you know, the exact kind of things that you're telling us, you know, you were looking to avoid for so long, you know, and this is how cannabis is now coming to the public. What are your feelings about that?
It's, you know, one of the great things about the California market is it's just going down the shitter. And unfortunately, everybody's losing their money and stuff like that. But for somebody like me, you know what? I've been waiting for this moment to roll out my genetics.
Right. Exactly right.
And so, you know, it's kind of like this perfect time. And you know, part of my business plan is to really just make sure, you know, I mean, you have no idea how much this means for me to talk to you guys, because this is the essence of what I want to do. I want to talk to like-minded people that love to get high, not fucked up, and really want and are, you know, creative people with something that they do and that they pass on from generation and raise cool kids. And I mean, that's it. And so, you know, we're looking for all the opportunities now to place these things. And again, I've always been pretty much free. Everything I've done in the Suns, I've pretty much been lucky enough to just be able to, I'd like to think that I'd been able to think through my opportunities and pick the ones that were pretty benign and leave the really sacred ones to the world of nonprofit us, you know? And so that's still the plan. And now that I'm at such an amazing level of talking to geneticists, and right now we're involved with doing the traditional method of plant preserving, you know, dry and pressing plants, doing the chemical analysis, getting them on agar to where all of my marijuana is going to be documented like Darwin did, or like, you know, museums do. And I'm just bypassing the whole marijuana business, and I'm going to the deepest traditional practice because it just makes sense. And because it's documenting the plants and keeping them for posterity and trying to. So in all that effort, it really sets up a little different direction that just the component parts of it are more science minded, more, you know, it's just a bigger idea, I think, you know? And, you know, and then you die. So who knows? And I know enough Silicon Valley people that says, well, it's just a matter before the ship gets stolen. You know, that's just how it works. And if it does, you know, I've been doing this for so long and trying to keep this stuff available because I felt like it was a responsibility. When somebody tells me, I know somebody's got great, great weed, it's got to be better than yours. I said, God, that's so great. If you could get me just a little, because if I could smoke that really incredible weed, then I wouldn't be tripping so hard on my weed. You know, I'd just play music. I'd just grow my stash. I'd cut cuttings loose to everybody. It would be great. Okay, the light has finally shone on my pretty good effort, you know? But nobody's done that yet.
Interesting.
And it's been 50 years.
Terry, the truth is we could talk to you all day and, you know, given the opportunity and quite frankly, if we could and sit down and, you know, be able to smoke with you too, it would be all the much the better and take turns pulling the tunes out. But this is great. So here is my question for you along those lines. And this is something that I'm always asking because I'm always looking for something new. You get home after a hard day, you sit down to relax, you smoke your favorite Haggalicious product. What music do you put on?
Boy, you know what? We don't have, my wife's a musician too, and she's an excellent singer and a teacher, and we do not have a sound system.
Well, we don't put music on.
We, for the most part, we don't put music on.
Just
you
play
know?
It and sing it.
Yeah, we live in such a, and I mean, if I was going to put on music, you know, I'd be putting on really music with really deep, complex harmonics. You know, I'd put on some Mozart or, you know, stuff that really is just got like all those roots. And it's not like I don't like to listen to things because,
sure,
you know, I've learned a lot. You know, I guess this would be a good insight into my musical hubris is we were driving back home the other day and all of a sudden Howling Wolf came on doing Spoonful. And when I was a kid, I would listen to that stuff and I go, God, they can't even play. The guy can't sing. And I was listening to it going, this is perfect. This is pure. This is an unbelievable moment in time. I mean, it is so pure. My idol Hubert Sumlin playing guitar, you know, a voice like you've never heard, lyrics that are so just perfect for the time. It's like, but I was just too dumb and too self-absorbed to really be able to hear it. So it's almost like only later in my life can I even really engage in some of the gifts that you have that I wish that I wasn't so wrapped up in me that I had earlier.
Okay.
But, you know, that's learning curve.
So perhaps you can answer the age-old question. Can you tell the difference between Spoonful and Smokestack Lightning when you hear it?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, the roots are the roots, you know? I mean, and there's, you know, when you play a lot of stuff and play a lot of rock, you know, there's only a, you know, a really handful of really driving things that, you know, like I was lucky enough to be able to back up Chuck Berry a few times and talk to Chuck Berry, you know, pretty intimately. And, you know, you just realize, like, I'm sitting there talking to him and I'm going, my God, almost every amazing, like, rocking feeling that I love to feel being a kid of the 50s and the early 60s, this is the guy that did it. And then he looks over at me because we're in the back room and he says, would you play Misty for me? And I go, sure. So I play Misty for him, play a nice chord solo and stuff like that. And he looked at me and went, oh, I always wanted to be a jazz guitar player, but I realized I wasn't good enough. And, you know, it was like this light bulb going on. It's like we all have this thing that is just so filled with self-doubt and just it's almost so blinding we can't see outside of it, you know. And here I'm talking to the guy that I listened to forever and ever and ever, and he's just spilling the beans. I'm like, oh, I'm not good enough. I'm sorry, you know.
Wow.
And coming from Chuck Berry, because Chuck can really get pretty screwed up. I mean, that was pretty great. Yeah.
That's just amazing. Just amazing. Wow. Well, these are just great stories, and this is just fantastic. One thing I do want to ask you, if people want to get in touch with you, Terry, if they want to find out about Haggalicious, if they want to ask questions about seeds or genetics, what's the best way for folks to reach out to you?
Well, my email is terry@terryhaggerty.com, and I try to answer everything, and until it gets to the point where it's too much, you know, I do have somebody I'm working with who is an amazing person in the business who helps run one of the top five biggest companies in California, but our group only has to do with genetics and nothing to do with those big groups, but you know, we're working towards me having a few people to help me sort through all this stuff. And I try to answer everything. So send it to terry@terryhaggerty.com. And I'll get back to you sooner or later.
Well, that's just wonderful, Terry. And hopefully somewhere down the road, we'll be lucky enough to get you to come back on the show again and maybe tell some of the stories we didn't get to this time.
Well, Larry, if you wanted to give me an address off the air, we can take care of that really quick.
You got it, sir. That is just wonderful. That's what I always like to hear from my favorite musicians in the world.
It's a prerequisite almost, you know.
I understand. Well, Terry Haggerty, Sons of Champlin, and rock legend, cannabis legend, thank you so much for joining us on the Deadhead Cannabis Show today. It's really been a treat for us. Just couldn't be happier.
Oh God, I'm pleased. So thanks for Rob for sitting in your car and and doing it. Really great questions. And thanks, Dan, for actually making it possible. Great.
Our pleasure. And thank you to everyone. We're going to leave you right now with a final clip from the Sons of Champlin featuring our good friend and guest, Terry Haggerty. Be good, be safe, enjoy your cannabis responsibly. Thank you, everyone.
Listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Hi, I'm Gary, and I invite you to discover the Cannabis Podcast, a bi-weekly podcast focused on a Canadian's cannabis culture. I would be the Canadian, and my cannabis passion and culture has been building for 5 decades. I share that passion for this wonderful plant in every episode, through conversations with cannabis advocates and enthusiasts, stories about the ever-changing legal environment, and some hands-on testing of product in a segment I call Cultivar Corner. The Cannabis Podcast, a Canadian's cannabis culture, one toke at a time.